This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscawain. Hard to believe the iPad is only 5 years old. Well, the explosion in digital technology since then has reached toddlers and even babies. A recent survey done by researchers at the Einstein Health Network was an eye-opener. It found a surprising number of very young children using apps and playing games on tablets and smartphones. While the study is relatively small, some experts say it points to a larger trend, and there's concern that too much use of what's been dubbed digital candy at too young an age could affect brain development. Others say there hasn't been enough research to condemn the use of mobile devices by the very young, and that some apps can actually encourage learning. Here this hour to help us sort it out, Jennifer Zosh is Associate Professor of Human Development and Family Studies at Penn State Brandeis and is also Director of the Brandeis Child Development Lab, and she joins us in studio. Great to have you here, Jennifer.
Thank you. Good morning.
And a good morning to you. And Michael Rich is Associate Professor of Pediatrics at Harvard Medical School and practices adolescent medicine at Boston Children's Hospital, where he is also the founder and director of the Center on Media and Child Health. Michael, welcome.
Hi, thank you. And hi, Jennifer.
Hello.
So in doing research for this show, I'd read that researchers in this study were stunned by how early kids are being handed smartphones. Some of these children were six months old. So, but stunned is a pretty strong word. Michael, what was your reaction to this study?
I hate to say it, but I wasn't surprised at all. All you have to do is go to any restaurant these days and you will see very young children being put in front of tablets or smartphones as the pacifier to allow mom and dad to eat their dinner and have a conversation.
So, Jennifer, were you surprised by this?
No, I'm really in agreement as well. You're out in a restaurant, you're in a school, you're anywhere, and all you see are children on these devices. What really surprised me about this was the degree of multitasking that we see with our really young kids, kids that are on multiple kinds of media at one time. That for me was a real big eye-opener.
Well, all right, so my kids are older, and I'm still trying to get my brain wrapped around the image of a child under the age of one, knowing how to swipe a smartphone or a tablet. Let's start off by looking at what very young children developmentally are capable of mastering on digital devices. Obviously, they can learn to swipe. What can they comprehend, Jennifer?
I mean, I think that's a really good question, is that we want to think about what is it that children are actually getting from screens. We, with television, would see young children watching screens and television shows that they really couldn't comprehend. And we know that they're not really getting a lot from that. So I think that the really big question is, what is it that children at 8 months or a year or 2 years are actually able to comprehend from what they're seeing? And is that really meaningful? Because we know that children really learn a lot from observing what's going on around them, observing the other people around them. So what is it that they're getting from screens, I think, is a really big question. And it's a really hard one to be able to ask, because we can't ask an eight-month-old, so what did you just learn? And I think that we're going to see, now that we're seeing this type of use with kids at 8 months, 1 year, 2 years, we're going to see a lot of studies, behavioral studies, and probably neuroimaging studies trying to answer that exact question. What is it that they're getting?
Michael Rich, what are your thoughts?
And I would totally agree with everything Jennifer said. And I would add to that that we not only need to understand better what's going on in the moment for that eight-month-old, but we need to understand what those choices made of putting them in front of a screen instead of outdoors or having a conversation or reading a book do when they are 8 years old and 18 years old. In other words, we're dealing with a moving target here. We're dealing with a brain that is developing in response to the challenges, demands, and questions presented to it by the environment. And one thing we do know is that screens are a relatively impoverished stimulus for the growing brain when compared to human interaction, acting on the physical world, and open-ended, creative, problem-solving type play. So what we really need to understand is not just what's going on for them in the moment, but how that diverts or changes the trajectory of their neurodevelopment.
According to the Association for Psychological Science, digital apps directed at kids are a booming business. And I've read that 72% of the top apps for sale in Apple's App Store come from the toddler preschool category. And I'm going into this right now because, Michael, you had mentioned that I guess the screen time is impoverished. I think that was the word that you were using. So there's a huge market for these apps if they're all out there. Who is developing them? Do any or many have training in childhood education? Jennifer, you want to tackle that?
So I was actually just at a conference this week about looking at this, right? Because one of the pieces of work that I've done with some collaborators was trying to tackle this 80,000 educational app problem. There's 80,000 apps marked as education on the App Store. The majority of those are marketed towards preschoolers and toddlers. And in fact, when you talk to a lot of developers, they don't have degrees in child development, just like child development experts aren't out there necessarily developing apps. So I think what we really need to see is kind of this marriage between those two groups, right? So how is it that we can take what we know about child development and help app developers really harness and leverage what we can bring children? How can we leverage what we know about children to help them further their education?
So I want to get back to the word impoverished, Michael Rich. And I'm, if there are 80,000 apps, I guess what I'm trying to get at is there anything there in the 80,000 apps that would offer a rich educational experience for a very young child as compared to interacting with humans, going out and playing outside, unstructured playtime? What do you think?
We don't know, for starters. Okay. I mean, these 80,000 apps are not only not developed by child development folks, but the marketing folks know that if they slap the label educational on it without any supporting research, they will make the sales. And look at, and that's shown by, you know, the App Store and how many of them are sold. Here's the reality is that parents want to give their kids the best. But they also want to keep them quiet in the restaurant and when they're taking a shower or getting a meal on the table. And so they will buy something that says educational. From what we know from basic neurodevelopmental research, the features that are had by anything that's on a screen, whether it be purely receptive as in the television or interactive as in tablets and smartphones, is not as challenging, is not as demanding, is not as unpredictable and requiring of imagination and creativity as real life, or what we used to call real life. So if you were to look at the fundamentals, it is virtually impossible for these apps to be as good as the alternative. And that's really the issue here is, what is this displacing?
So I guess if you see something marketed as, say, Baby Genius, you kind of have to take that, maybe look at it hard and really consider what it is that you're purchasing. Why don't we, as we get into this show, Michael Rich, if you could give us a definition of what is happening in a child's brain as it's developing from, say, infant through the toddler years.
Well, we are born with all of our neurons that we'll ever get in place. What happens in the first 2 years of life dramatically, but really well into the third and fourth decade of life, is that we are building and making synaptic connections between those neurons. In other words, we are connecting those wires in ways that respond to what we're challenged by. One of the reasons we end up with arguably the most sophisticated brain in the animal kingdom is in part because we are born with an embryonic brain. We are born with a brain that is not ready to survive, is not ready to feed itself, is not ready to stay warm, is not, and it depends entirely on parents and other adults to protect and nurture that child. But what that means is we get to build the brain in response to the environment that it will have to function in. In the first 2 years of life, the brain triples in volume because of all these connections being made. And as importantly, there are billions of these synaptic connections that are pruned or killed off to improve our signal-to-noise ratio. If we are reinforcing those circuits that will be most robust in responding to the environment, we will end up with our brain as optimized as it can be. But unfortunately, screens, which at best are an analog of or a simulation of reality, an image of a cow that moves when you touch it, as opposed to a real cow, we are at risk of pruning away valuable connections that would help them be flexible and resilient and creative in response to reality. So, you know, that's an oversimplified look at it, but basically, use it or lose it. Mm-hmm. And do we want to train our kids to be really good on screens, or do we want to train our kids to be really good in the world?
Go ahead, Jennifer.
I was just going to add to that that I think what we want to do is train our children to be great thinkers. And the big thing here is, how do we leverage screens to help them do that? If our children are going to use screens, how do we make that time useful? Because I agree with Michael that, right, if it's much more meaningful for a child to see a cow on the farm. But I'm also thinking of a six-year-old who gets a chance to go on a digital safari and see animals that they might not have been able to see in their real life. So I think the real question is, how do we leverage about what we know about how children learn? How do we take the findings that we've generated over the last 4, 5, 6 decades from the science of learning to really find experiences that may actually be meaningful? And I think that we can't just throw up our hands and say all apps are just completely meaningless things and we shouldn't do them and children should never see screens. I agree with Michael that it's an issue of displacement. So if parents aren't spending time with their children and instead are throwing screens at them, sure, that's displacing some really meaningful things. But if you have a app that maybe promotes great parent-child interaction, that actually could be used as a tool. And I think that's really the key, is that you can't just give a child a tool and walk away. You want to interact with them and help scaffold their experience with that toy. So the science of learning has really given us some clues as to what might actually be educational.
So Jennifer, what is an example of an app in which there's great parent-child interaction?
Well, I think that you're seeing some apps are promoting those kinds of parent-child interactions. If we think about,
are they reading apps, or what are they doing together?
So I think that there's a lot of different kinds of apps. Reading apps are a good example of that. There's lots of apps that will just kind of take over the experience. The app will read to the child. It's easy for parents to take a back seat. And you know what? Sometimes that might be meaningful. That might be useful if a child is trying to work through words on their own, or if the parent needs 10 minutes to be able to make dinner. That might be something that's a better experience than watching television. Right, that might be something that's better than kind of not having a more positive experience. But we think about apps that are actually promoting some social interaction kid to kid, so child to child interaction, when they're playing a word game together. So there's some really great apps out there that are promoting social interaction, which we know is one of the four pillars of learning. We know that that's one of the ways that really helps promote learning and education. We also see some apps in which parents and children are engaged in the app exploration themselves. So I'm thinking of one in which children are asked to interact with their parent, and their parent provides feedback along the way.
Okay. I'd like to get to the American Academy of Pediatrics position on all this. We'll do that after the break. But in the meantime, I'll reintroduce our guest. Jennifer Zosh is Associate Professor of Human Development and Family Studies at Penn State Brandywine. Michael Rich is Associate Professor of Pediatrics at Harvard Medical School. Lines are open at 888-477-9499. Our email address is radiotimes@whyy.org. You can send us a tweet as well @WHYYRadioTimes. I'm Mary Cummings George. Jordan in for Marty Moskowane. There's more of Radio Times coming right up. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moskowane. This hour, we're discussing the fact that increasingly very young children are spending time on tablets and smartphones, and there's a huge market in digital apps directed at kids. Joining us now to help us navigate are Michael Rich, Associate Professor of Pediatrics at Harvard Medical School. He's also founder and director of the Center on Media and Child Health at Boston Children's Hospital. And Jennifer Zosh is Associate Professor of Human Development and Family Studies at Penn State Brandywine, and also director of the Brandywine Child Development Lab. And we've got some comments coming in, but we invite you to join the conversation. If you'd like, give us a call at 888-477-9499. Our email address is radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can send us a tweet @WHYYRadioTimes. Very interested in hearing from you if this is something that affects your life. So the American Academy of Pediatrics has for years advised parents to avoid screen time entirely for children 2 and under. this is changing. The quote from an AAP symposium earlier this year was, in a world where screen time is becoming simply time, our policies must evolve or become obsolete, I should say. New recommendations are expected next year. So children aren't changing physically or psychologically. Is, Michael Rich, the takeaway from this that we simply need to adapt to a rapidly evolving new normal here?
Yeah, I think that we have to stop looking, first of all, at the devices as the vectors of either education or harm, and start recognizing the fact that our children are living in an environment that is saturated with screens and other media. You are often in places with three or four or more screens visible from where you stand at that moment. And that doesn't even count the one that's sitting in your pocket. So we need to shift our paradigm from thinking of these as potential perils or promise, but more as the air they're breathing and the water they're drinking. The second thing is we need to move beyond the values-based paradigm that leads us to call the television the boob tube or the idiot box, to one that is based in evidence and approach it much the way we're approaching nutrition. In other words, pediatricians don't tell parents never to feed their children junk food, but we do teach them the difference between what happens to their child's body when they eat junk food as opposed to eating broccoli, and then trust that parents will use that information in ways that are hopefully to the benefit of the child. I think what happened with the values base was that it became right and wrong, and when parents heard, don't show your children television under the age of two, they just clicked the pediatricians off and said, I can't do that. I can't get a shower or get a meal on the table without the television. And we need to be in a dialogue about how to learn to live well and raise children well in an environment that is admittedly media saturated.
So, Michael Rich, how much screen time do you think should be allowed for young children every day?
I actually don't use the concept of screen time at all. And the reason for that is that first of all, it requires determining whether your child's homework, which happens as early as kindergarten now on the iPad, is considered screen time or not. You're, again, in this good screen time versus bad screen time thing. The second reason for it is that it makes screen time a forbidden fruit. And something that needs to be restricted by mom or dad is something that must be really desirable. And so what happens is that that becomes the first priority. That becomes the first thing they do when they arrive home from school. And at the end of that period of time, whatever it is, which is done before anything else, they don't stop on their own. So 15 minutes after the stop time, mom comes and says, you know, your time was up 15 minutes ago. Can I get to the end of the program? Can I level up in the game, et cetera? And it creates a conflict every time. So the concept that we use based on the research is to sit down with your child of any age from five on, really, and say, let's look at what you like to do and what you need to do in a day. You need this many hours of sleep, which, by the way, is one of the things that suffers the most from excessive screen time. You need a sit-down family meal every day. You need outdoor playtime. You need time with your family and friends. Some kids, you need homework. Now, how much time is left? You're doing several things. One is you're teaching your child to prioritize. You're teaching your child to manage their time, which is something we could all be better at. And you are modeling for them behaviors that they can use throughout their life of putting their entertainment, putting their diversion into context with the things they really need to do.
Jennifer Zosh, what do you think about very young children in screen time? What would you like to see in restrictions?
Right. So I think that I agree with Michael on that. It's hard to just label this screen time because screen time can look very, very different. It can be watching a mindless thing that kids are just really zoning out on, or it can be something that they're sitting next to their parents on the couch talking about shapes or talking about math. There's been some studies out there just starting to look at the educational potential or the potential benefits of using apps that maybe help parents and children have more meaningful conversations. So I think I agree with Mike on that. We can't just throw the label screen time on it and say you need 45 minutes and that's it. I think we really do want to think about structuring. What do we want our children's days to look like? And using that as the base rather than just screen time.
Well, I want to get to some calls and comments here because they're really coming in. But I want to flip the question then. So how much unplugged time do you think a child should have per day?
Well, I think that really, I mean, I think all families are different, right? So what kinds of opportunities children have, how much screen time are they seeing in schools or are they not seeing in schools? What kinds of opportunities? I really do agree that it's an issue of displacement. What is it that the screen, that interacting with screens is taking time away from? Because what we're seeing in terms of any potential negative effects of screen time might not be coming from the screens themselves, but from what we're not doing instead of that. So instead of a child having a really meaningful interaction with a parent, if they're just on a tablet by themselves, that's probably not as meaningful.
So, Michael, Rich, I mean, studies have shown that any type of screen time, including television, of course, can lead to a sedentary lifestyle and, you know, their connections to obesity. What are the negatives in not having unplugged time? What are some of the other negatives?
The negatives are that you are giving away time that, when unplugged, is less predictable, is less, you know, rote. The reality is that watching television, even the best of educational apps, are, you know, a series of pre-planned, preconceived events, really, conceived and created by someone else. And even though it seems like the child is driving even the educational app that they're interacting with, there are certain decision trees that are all pre-mapped by someone else. And what you're giving away is time when they can sit in the backyard and look at the wind blow through the leaves of the tree and watch them fall, you know, in the fall. Or they can sit down with a sandbox and a bucket of water and a bunch of sticks and build a city. Or they can have a conversation with a parent or throw a ball around with their friends or siblings. So what you're giving away is the spontaneity of life, the creativity, the freedom of thought that allows creative imagination to occur. One of the things that I often say is bring back boredom. Why would anybody want to bring back boredom? We spend all our time trying to stimulate our children so that they're never bored. But the reality is that boredom creates the space for new ideas, for creativity and imagination to occur.
Okay, I did promise that we would get to the phones, and so let's do so. Linda in Downingtown, you're live on Radio Times. Welcome, Linda.
Thanks for taking my call. This is so fascinating. My husband and I have these kinds of conversations almost daily. But my question is this. I'm an older mom from the time when we didn't have these devices. The computers were just coming into play. And one of the things we were taught from pediatric development was that in order for children to be, you know, socialize and bond with the parents, there had to be a lot of eye contact time. So like in the store, you were looking at the faces, you were making eye chatting. That's how they learned visual expression and this and that. And I'm curious, is that going to be changing fundamentally? Because now so many children, it seems, are being plugged in at the store, at the restaurants from an early age. And I don't see a lot of interaction as far as, you know, what makes us human. Thanks very much.
Oh, thank you for the call, Linda, to Radio Times. Jennifer Zosh, you want to tackle that one?
Linda, I think you actually bring up a really great point, which is we've so far in this conversation talked about kids and screens. We haven't yet touched on parents and screens, because the truth is, children aren't the only ones who are plugged in. So if you're, you know, I do research at children's museums, and when I walk around, I see children playing in the exhibit and parents are off on the back at the back on their phones. So I think that really brings up a key point of not only do we have to think about the interactions that we're providing children by giving them a tablet, but what are we doing when we are sitting at dinner and we're on our phones? What are we doing when we are...
What are we telling them?
What are we telling them? And that's one of the things that didn't get covered in the media quite as much with the Academy of Pediatrics changing their tune a little bit, which is that they actually said in their report that came out that role modeling is critical, that you really need to be modeling to, for children how you want them to be. So if you're always on your phone and you're always plugged into something else and not your child, you are modeling that behavior to them. And I think that's something that's really important that parents need to think about, too, is what is it that they themselves are doing?
There's a recommendation for tech-free zones. That specifically is during the day, saying, okay, we're going to set this time aside, whether it's dinner time or right after school, in which everything is put away. Michael Rich, what do you think about that?
I'm assuming
you'll say thumbs up.
In fact, one of the things that I recommend to my patients is a digital Sabbath. For centuries, many, many cultures have had a Sabbath in which they put their daily cares aside and focus on what's really important, focus on family, focus on conversation, focus on deep reflective thought. And I think that we are so busy stimulating ourselves 24/7 that we never put these devices down and just liberate ourselves from them. Now, when I suggest this, particularly kids, but parents also look at me like I'm completely nuts. Like, how could I possibly do that? But those that actually try it come back and say, OMG, this is the greatest thing I've ever done, because I was free for once of having to reflexively respond to every text, to every email, to every Groupon announcement. And they take the time to be with each other and to reconnect. And I think that what we have done is we have traded away our connectedness with each other, which is probably the single most protective thing we can do for kids, for connectivity with a much bigger world. And I think we've come up with the short end of the stick on that one. Connectedness is the single best thing that can happen in life, but it's riskier. Intimacy is risky, and I think that we as parents not only need to model these behaviors for our kids, but we need to be there for our kids. I hear from patients all the time, if I ask them, what one thing could your parents do better in their parenting, across the board what I hear is, pay attention to me.
Look at me, talk to me. Mm-hmm. And no, don't be distracted by anything else.
Right.
Michael Rich, I just want, before we get back to the calls, I just wanted to address a physical question. Experts say the use of devices can give people a dopamine squirt. Dopamine, the brain chemical associated with pleasure. But, I mean, that's a very physical thing. And and I'm obviously not a scientist. Can you just briefly get into that and why that might help these devices be so alluring and hard to get away from?
Absolutely. I mean, dopamine is the neurotransmitter in our brain that is released when we feel accomplishment, when we win a football game, when we have sex, when we eat. This is our pleasure, but not just pleasure. It is success and competence and confidence. And so these games, many of them are very intelligently designed to provide just enough frustration that it is a sense of accomplishment when you overcome it, and it will give you that dopamine squirt that in the brain that makes you feel like you've just won that football game.
So Jennifer Zosh, if a parent is looking at apps, especially for a very young child, what do they need to look for to the best of their ability to determine if it really is educational? You were talking about the four principles or the four pillars earlier.
Right. So my colleagues and I really wanted to scour the literature to try to abstract some principles that might help guide parents and importantly also guide teachers, app developers, really try to extract out of decades worth of research what are some things that might actually make this experience meaningful. And I want to clarify that it's not just about apps, it's any experience, because kids can have a really great experience out in nature, or they might sit on a bench and that is it, and not really engage with people around them or with the experience that they're having. So we identified four pillars of learning. The first is that you need to look if your child is active. And by active, we mean minds on. Not that they're just tapping and swiping, because anyone who's played a lot of Candy Crush knows that you can do a lot of tapping and swiping and maybe not a lot of thinking. But are children's brains being engaged? Do you see them trying to do problem solving, or do you just see them moving their finger around randomly until something happens? So you can ask yourself, is my child minds on? Are they actively thinking about what's in front of them? And whether that be on a tablet, whether that be on television, whether that be sitting on the living room floor. A second thing that we look at is engagement. And by engagement, what we mean is that you're not distracted. And one of the things that we saw is that a lot of apps rely on bells and whistles, pop-ups, hotspots, things that will pop up. And what we actually find in research looking at electronic versus traditional toys, and also electronic and traditional books, is sometimes those can actually distract away from children understanding what's going on. We termed it the fire alarm syndrome. If you remember back to grade school, when the fire alarm would go off, you'd go outside, you'd come back in, you have absolutely no recollection of what it was you were just learning about. So are the apps that we're exposing children to, do they provide enough stimulation, but that doesn't take away from the learning goal, that's the objective that we see?
Okay, we're coming up to a break, so quickly, the other two.
Meaningful. Can kids see meaning in it in their actual everyday lives? Do they make those connections? Knowing that a triangle has what a triangle looks like is really meaningful when you know that that's also the shape of the pizza that you see. And then also socially interactive. Can it help promote positive social interaction between parents and children or children and children that we know can actually help increase the educational value?
So if you're looking at different apps as a parent for a very young child, is it obvious which choices to stay away from?
Not from the app store, right? Because we don't have there's not researchers that are evaluating every app that comes on the market. Hundreds of apps are entering the market every day. There's just not enough resources to do that. But what I think it requires is for parents to download something and just spend a little bit of time. It's not that you need to spend 3 hours. It's not that you need to hire a researcher to come and do this for you. But look at the app. Think about what is it that my child's being engaged in here. And then if you play your app with the app alongside your child, see, are they really actively thinking about it? And can you connect this to their everyday lives? Because just like parents can make anything meaningful, they can make educational apps meaningful too.
Okay. This hour, we're looking at very young children and their use of smartphones and tablets. What are the benefits? What are the negatives? I promise we are going to get to some of these telephone calls right after the break. Our guests this hour, Jennifer Zosh, Associate Professor of Human Development and Family Studies at Penn State Brandywine, and Michael Rich, a director of the Center on Media and Child Health at Boston Children's Hospital. Lines are open. Well, they're stacking up, but we can probably take another call or so. 888-477-9499. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain. Stay with us. This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain. And we're talking about the fact that increasingly very young children, toddlers and infants, are spending time on tablets and smartphones, and how might this affect them in a positive or negative way. Our guests are Michael Rich, Associate Professor of Pediatrics at Harvard Medical School, also founder and director of the Center on Media and Child Health at Boston Children's Hospital, and Jennifer Zosh is Associate Professor of Human Development and Family Studies at Penn State Brandywine, where she's also director of the Brandywine Child Development Lab. And as promised, we are going to get to the phones. Tina in Bucks County, you've been very patient. Welcome to Radio Times.
Hello.
Hi, Tina.
Hi. I really appreciate that you guys are talking about this. And I agree with what the doctor was saying about the negative impacts of not having the natural stimulation and the connection with the child's natural environment. Something that's really concerning is... I haven't heard anything about the radiation exposure and the actual vibrational frequency of these devices that we've had years ago. We've had pictures of brain waves and cell phones that weren't even iPhones that had less electromagnetic frequency.
Tina?
And I think it's very, yes.
I'm just going to jump in because I think we have a phone line, a phone connection that's not that great. But I did get your concern about radiation. Michael Rich, could you address that with these devices?
Yes, this is an interesting area of research and also significant controversy, particularly around cell phones and cell phones used by kids, because their skulls are actually thinner than adults. And so if a cell phone which does not receive signal but actually radiates signal is held against the head, there's actually evidence that, from research done by Nora Volkoff, who's head of the National Institute of Drug Abuse, that shows that the neurons closest to the ear actually are heated up when a cell phone is being used. Now, moving from that to long-term implications, there is some epidemiologic evidence of increased head and neck tumors in some people, which has then been associated with heavy use of either cell phones or other radio frequency devices such as walkie-talkies. Unfortunately, this has not gotten much traction out there in the research or clinical world, and so we aren't doing much about this yet. And I think that it's good for us to pay attention to things like this, but also to pay attention to the larger picture that frankly affects many, many more people, which is the influence of using these devices on the way our kids are developing their cognitive and social emotional selves.
Thanks for the call to Radio Times, Tina. So, Michael, what would you recommend with smartphones, that the kids don't hold them, especially the very young, that they hold them out a certain distance from their heads?
Well, here's the reality. Kids don't use phones as phones. They don't hold them against their heads anyway. They use them as texting and social media and internet surfing platforms. So they're holding them away from their body themselves. But if they are using them in a talk mode, we actually recommend that you use a wired, not wireless, headset. And the reason is that Bluetooth also emits radiation. Again, is this a significant amount of radiation given the high level of background radiation we're all exposed to, because these microwaves are passing through us all the time? So I think that we have to put it in context and understand that, yes, it probably will reduce our risk of a very rare event.
Okay, back to the phones. Kathy, welcome to Radio Times. Kathy in Downington.
Hi, everyone.
Hi.
Are you there?
Sure.
I wanted to go back to a question that got raised briefly earlier, and that was that I understood that the reason that it was originally recommended that under twos not use phones and watch TV and stuff was that it somehow affected the neurological and cognitive development. Was that research wrong? Did I misunderstand that there was actually research showing such stuff? Or why is this now okay if there was such research? Does that make sense?
Jennifer Zosh?
I think what you were really seeing with the original under twos, absolutely no screen time ruling, it was a very precautionary approach. The truth of the matter is the landscape of childhood is changing really, really dramatically. And research takes a decent amount of time to be able to show something statistically and to be able to show something in a really scientifically rigorous way. So in a world in which tablets were just coming on the market, and we're really seeing kids as young as 1 and 2 using, we don't have the research yet to be able to say, yes, do not ever give your child this tablet. So I think that what you're really seeing is that it wasn't so much that there was research that was wrong that said this was really bad. We're really kind of thinking that we have to be mindful about the experiences that we're giving our kids. So the early rule about absolutely no screen time for kids under two was saying, let's really not take any risks with this. But now that we're seeing parents are using it anyway, what you're seeing the new statement being is, well, let's continue to do the research. Let's see what are the ways to maximize the benefits of this, but then also how do we decrease any potential negative benefits. So I don't think it's so much that the research has changed. It's just that we're seeing a change in tune based off of the changing landscape of childhood.
How big a lag is there between the science and the the technology, scientific knowledge, and about the risks of technology?
Well, I think it depends on what kind of risks that you're talking about in terms of long-term, because the truth is we don't know what it's like in terms of long-term. We don't know what happens if you use a tablet when you're 5 and then what happens when you're 25. They haven't been around long enough for us to know that. I mean, so, there's some research out there to find that actually finds that children can do better with math if they practice math with their parents using an app rather than just not having that kind of experience. So I think we're starting to see research come onto the market, but what we really wanted to do was look at what do we know about childhood generally and how can we apply that to this ever-changing technology?
Thank you for the call to Radio Times, Kathy. So I guess the bottom line is, since the research is lagging behind the science, again, what is the parental approach here? You've got all this technology. Is it just kind of approach with caution, approach with care, really research it? You know, try as little as possible. We know we've all been in the bind where we're trying to get dinner on, you know, right, and you're trying to distract the kids. What is the approach in light of the fact that the science is lagging?
For me, it's really about being mindful. What are the way? What do you want your child's day to look like? What is it that you want them to get out of their experiences? So if you can use, if you want to sit down and look at a storybook app with your child and point out the great things that are going on and have a lot of fun with it and that can help promote that those positive parent-child interactions, I think that's really great. I think it's really about mindfulness. What do you want your child's experience to be like? These tablets, these smartphones are just tools. And they can be leveraged or they can just sit there and not help anything. So I think it really stresses the role of parents. Do you want your child to be sitting there and not talk to you for 3 hours? I don't think that's what most parents would want. So I think parents need to feel empowered to be able to do what feels right to them and to model positive interactions with their own phones. I mean, I think most adults would probably agree that they don't have really positive relationships with their phones or their tablets. So I think it's about being mindful. How can you use this as a tool that helps promote positive things and not just as a digital babysitter? And think about whether or not is this experience they're having, can you help relate it to their everyday lives? Does it make your interaction with your child more positive? Mm-hmm. Or is it just digital candy?
Okay. Michael Rich, go ahead.
Can I build on that a little bit?
Sure.
I want to build on the concept that Jennifer brought up, which is this is a tool, and we don't want to confer any special powers of either evil or good to it. It's a tool, and she's absolutely right that spending more time doing math with your child will help their child perform better in math. But an app isn't the only way to do it, and I think that we have to look at these tools and say, are these the best tool for this job? But keep in mind the fundamental that the important transaction here is that your child is doing math or your child is reading, your child is spending time having a conversation with you. And if the app and the device support that, amen, use it. But also understand that there is displacement, and is there another way to do it? Is there a way that might even be better than the app?
Michael Rich, one of our callers had some more questions about perhaps physical side effects. He or she was wondering about tech neck, which might be bad for a young child developing, you know, staring down at technology. And also, too, I'd read, too, in the New York Times that sometimes there's a narrowing of the blood vessels in the eye, and it's not certain what the long-term consequences of this might be. Could you address that?
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing any number of physical outcomes of this use, from text neck to hypertrophic thumbs from playing video games.
This is from a lot of use, right?
I'm sorry?
This is from a lot of use. Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But, you know, if you look at the current, you know, census of media use, these kids are, on average, using it a lot. You know, they're spending a lot of time with these devices and using these devices. So, you know, just as what is going on for the child's developing mind is something that we need to be mindful of, we also need to be mindful of what's going on for their body. You know, we used to talk about the couch potato in front of the television, you know, just vegging out on the couch, and instead maybe get up and move. I think that we just have to be aware of, first of all, what it is we're doing physically, mentally, and emotionally, but also what the alternatives to that activity are when we are using media.
Vicki, in Doylestown, welcome to Radio Times. We'll take your call.
Hello. I'm a psychotherapist, and one of the outcomes I see of this is what I've labeled electronics depression. I see a lot of young people who interact more with electronics than they do with their friends. The sleepover doesn't seem to be happening. They notice when they get out of the house that they have energy, but most of the time they don't. And the reason I'm relating this to now is because they've been so indoctrinated to these machines that they really can't conceive of themselves getting together as much as, let's say, in my day or my kids' day. When you ask a parent what do they want most for their children, they want them to be happy. But if they are indoctrinating them to machines, they're not going to be happy in the future because they don't even know how to socialize.
All right, Vicki, we appreciate your call to Radio Times. Michael Rich, electronic depression. What do you think?
You know, I think that what we're seeing here is not electronic depression, but depression at disconnectedness. One of the things we know from decades of research is that connectedness with family, with friends, with the community, with school are the, you know, perhaps the most protective thing that we can do for our children is to encourage that. And these devices in some ways make it too easy to create an analog or a simulacrum, if you will, of truly connecting with people. And so one of the things that I actually recommend both to my patients and through my online advice column for Parenting Digital Natives, Ask the Mediatrician, is when you're thinking of interacting with someone, upgrade by one. No one wants restrictions, but they love the concept of an upgrade to business class or even first class. And so if you're thinking of Instagramming text, if you're thinking of texting, pick up the phone and call. If you're thinking of calling, get together in person. We use these devices to interpose between us and others as a way of avoiding intimacy, which is ultimately risky, but much more satisfying. And that intimacy is what leads to true connectedness.
Jennifer Zosh, I'd like to bring into the conversation this Common Sense Media update. We were talking about it just before we went on air, and it relates not to the very young children, but 8 to 18. How many hours on average are these our kids using various types of screen media?
Of media, exactly. Yeah. So on any given day, American teenagers ages 13 to 18 average about 9 hours of entertainment media use, excluding time spent at school or homework. And for tweens, so 8 to 12-year-olds, they average about 6 hours worth of entertainment media daily. So this is time outside of school. This is time not doing homework. This is that extra time when we've talked about how do you want your child's day to be? What is it that you want to stress? And I think this brings it back to this issue of connectedness. Do you want your child to only be staring at a screen, or do you want them to be out and about and being able to interact with their friends and for you to interact with them as well? So I really think, again, we're seeing this changing landscape. But how do we leverage that in really positive ways? I think about this idea of the screen standing in the way of interaction, and in some ways it can. But in other ways, I think about the three-year-old who is Skyping or FaceTiming with their grandparents states away, and they would never have had that interaction before this. So I think the issue is how do we leverage these devices and have them be tools that help promote things like connectedness rather than not thinking about it and seeing what happens.
Michael Rich, Skype and FaceTime, you are reading verbal cues, you are talking to somebody. What do you think of those types of media?
I think they're wonderful, particularly for reaching out to people who are at a distance where you can't get together with them in person. I think one thing we have to be aware of with very young children sometimes is whether they are capable of really understanding what's going on. I remember one of the first times that my wife was away from my then 2-year-old son, and we decided she would Skype in at night from the hotel room at the meeting she was at, and he completely flipped out because he saw something that kind of looked like her, that really sounded like her, but he couldn't have her. So I think we have to not make assumptions that it is the same experience for children as it is for all of us. However,
Michael Rich, I'm going to have to stop you there because we're running short of time. We could have gone another hour with this one. Our thanks to you, Michael, Associate Professor of Pediatrics at Harvard Medical School and founder of director of the Center on Media and Child Health at Boston Children's Hospital. And Jennifer Zosh, a pleasure, professor, Associate Professor of Human Development and Family Studies at Penn State Brandywine. And don't forget to check out our Facebook page and podcasts at whyy.org/radiotimes. Our engineer today has been Kevin Griffin, our producers Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. And our intern is Diana Allen. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain on Radio Times. Thanks for joining us.